Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, Managing Director of Elcut Global. Our mission is to connect the supply chain ecosystem by bringing forward the most interesting leaders in the industry. And it's my pleasure to have with us today David Collins, who is the CEO of China Manufacturing Consultants. David brings 35 years of manufacturing experience across computer, automotive, aerospace, furniture, and chemical industries. He has worked for General Motors and Chrysler, as well as Foxconn and Jabil. He built and managed several automotive plants in North America, successfully turned around a Foxconn Mexico plant in the middle of the swine flu crisis in 2009-2010, as well as for the last 10 years has been living and working in China. His company, the China Manufacturing Consultants, is a manufacturing consulting firm that advises and executes on manufacturing initiatives from the boardroom all the way to the shop floor and works extensively with clients across industries including Shell, IKEA, ThyssenKrupp or Apple. David, thanks a lot for making the time and joining us today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
And wanted to kind of frame the conversation in the perspective of this coronavirus crisis that pretty much is not to be ignored by anybody because it's affecting all the planet at the moment. And I wanted to get your perspective specifically from a manufacturing side, because in the last couple of months, we have seen first a supply chain crisis, a supply crisis in China, because there was a lockdown after the Chinese New Year for 3 to 6 weeks. Now there is a demand crisis also in China, because the virus situation has been put under control, but at the same time, it's not under control in the markets of demand like Europe or US or Canada. So basically, there's been two situations. So one, not supply, then demand crisis. What are you seeing from a manufacturing perspective? What has happened from your clients, and what have you seen happening across this last couple of months?
Well, in China, I see three different things happening. I mean, if you're in the medical field, you're going like crazy, to the point where people who aren't even in the medical field are popping up and trying to build medical products that, you know, they don't even know really how to build. And I'm sure you've seen some of the problems with some of that. And the Chinese government's now trying to control that so that, you know, their only really good products are getting made. So the people I know that are in the medical field, in fact, I was on one of the owners of a company's with them yesterday night, his business is going like crazy. They're selling. They're even asking to see if they can find more suppliers, and they're looking in other parts of the world for suppliers also. You have the second group of people who started up, did sort of fulfilled orders, but now are starting to have some issues with demand. And those people, I would say, would be more in the consumer industries, you know, because a lot of consumer goods stores are closed, clothing stores, shoe stores. In many countries, they're considered non-essential. So they've closed those stores and the demand is down. And also we have some clients in the sporting goods space that really have a lot of problems, because, you know, almost all sports have been ceased. And so, you know, the sales of hockey sticks, of baseball bats, of, you know, gloves and things like that, anything going with that have gone down. And so you see those kinds of companies starting to shut down, and those kind of companies, I think some of them are going to go bankrupt. In fact, there was one estimate from one person in China saying that they estimate maybe 20% of those companies are going to go bankrupt, leaving just maybe some of the bigger, stronger companies left to continue going. And then you see the third group, and the third group is sort of like in the automotive, aerospace space, basic chemicals, things like that, that are starting to come back up as the automotive industry will start building cars again. Of course, in the automobile industry, supply chain is so important because they use mostly just in time. So the questions will be, you know, have the Chinese suppliers that are there or any suppliers from around the world been affected? Because the problem with automobiles, if you have just one supplier that isn't isn't up, there's not a second supplier for it. They partner with the suppliers very, very closely to save costs. And so you'll see some issues in the automobile industry and the aerospace industry, because again, you have a very, very unique set of suppliers that are very specifically set for those kinds of products. And they're starting to start up again. Wuhan was a big area for those kinds of people, and Wuhan just started opening up 100% last week, gradually. So I think you'll start to see those kind of products start to get back onto the market, and hopefully you'll see the automotive, aerospace, and some of the other big ticket items start producing again in the next 2 to 3 weeks. In the United States, it looks like General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford are already talking about starting up. The German automakers in Germany will probably start up in the next week or two as Germany starting to open its economy. So those are pretty much the three types of things we're seeing. We also see a problem with clients who need help. A lot of people would have sent people to China to go help start up after Chinese New Year. And now that was a couple months ago, but they can't. So people from clients in the West or in Australia, Japan, or whatever, who normally would have sent people to China to start up, they can't get their people there. So this is causing some quality issues. People are not there for maybe some new production. The new product introduction parts aren't going as well as they should, we're seeing. So actually for us, we're getting a little bit of business. People are calling us and asking us to go in and help them with their MPI and work like that, which is good for my company, but it's not necessarily good for the manufacturers themselves, because you know, sometimes you need your own engineers there to make sure that what you engineered is good. So there's some problems with that now that China's shut down.
Mm. Wanted to drill a little bit deeper from the third big bucket that you mentioned, the automotive. You have aerospace, industrial equipment, I guess, would fall under that as well. I guess on the one side, production is resuming. On the other side, just as we've seen with demand in the consumer goods, it just basically is not there. I mean, I on a personal note, I don't necessarily see somebody buying a car. Let's take it as an example in the next 6 to 12. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm a little bit pessimistic, but I don't see a lot of people going to the auto shop to buy a car in the next 6 to 12 months, because I think we are yet to have seen the full extent of this crisis, right? And obviously economically it has hurt a lot of people, and hopefully it will stop soon. But I see an issue on the demand side still for these industries that are producing pretty expensive items, right? Do you see this demand hitting them as well, or how do you see from this perspective?
I think you're totally correct. The automobile companies have been down now a couple months. That's an awful long time for auto factories not to make products. So the real question is what they have on their lots is sufficient for how long? And then new model introductions will start in this is April, so May, June, and then all of a sudden you're hitting into the shutdowns to retool for new automotive production for the new model years that happen in usually July and early August, and then they start producing cars, you know, for the next model year. So that will be a big question. Will people start retooling? Will they just shut down because there's no demand and then retool and keep it down for another few months? Or will they try to build up some stock of the 2020 models before they start going into the 2021 models and cars? Equipment, heavy equipment, I think might keep going, because everywhere I go, I still see construction still going on. It looks like construction hasn't really slowed down. Right now I'm in Dubai, and even though we're in total lockdown in Dubai right now, the construction of buildings continues to go on. We're doing some factory construction in other parts of the Middle East and even China. And most of the people are want to do that. So hopefully the heavy equipment industry will help keep that going. And the demand for airlines has to be hurt because the airline industry is getting crushed. I saw a map, you know, there's that map that shows all the planes that are flying at any given time. And they showed before the virus and after the virus, and the sky was full of planes, and now the sky is almost empty of planes. So will people start going after, with very little cash, start going after new planes? I doubt it. I think some of those orders will get hurt. So the auto industry obviously will be affected. I agree with you. If you're worried about making your mortgage payment or buying a new car, you're going to make your mortgage payment first. And so that is something that could hit. And once these factories start up, will they all of a sudden then shut down again? They might maybe run 2 or 3 weeks and then shut down because there's too many cars on the dealer lots. And that's a strong possibility.
Mm. And I think we've seen already, I mean, in the US specifically, I was reading some studies that they're running out of parking lots because, you know, there's so much finished goods, finished cars, and then they have nothing to do with it and nobody's buying, obviously, so that there's some issues around that. Kind of going slightly to the, I've gotten a lot of questions coming from our audience in Europe, in US, Canada, even Australia, that are now slowly coming, you know, or planning to come back to a certain activity level, to ease the lockdown, to go back to more, you know, to more manufacturing, more activities in the manufacturing across industries space. And I wanted to ask you, from what you have observed that happened in China, that have already done that for the last 4 to 8 weeks, they've come back to some level of normality. Actually, they've done it quite well. What are some positive or good case studies of how to do that properly, how to do that well, that you could share that maybe might benefit people that are listening to this?
In the good and the bad, so I'll sort of put them together, sort of the do's and the don'ts. The people that came up well were people that had a plan. People who didn't have much machinery in China, and that's one of the advantages of China, there's not a lot of machinery, so to speak, there's an awful lot of still manual labor. People were able to come up faster with the manual labor as long as the labor was able to be there. For a while in China, if you came from a different province, you had to do 14 days of lockdown, quarantine and things like that. So, you know, maybe you had 30 to 40% from your local province, and then people from another province came in and they had to wait. And that's still happening in different parts of the world. We have clients here in the Middle East, as well as in China, that are looking for labor, but they have some labors coming back slowly, you know, because, for example, a lot of labor was in Hubei province and they had to get back. So you have to plan that, see what's going to happen. The people who had more local labor started up quickly. That was very good. People who, so if you were more in the center of the country of China, you started up well. But if you were in a place like Shenzhen, which almost all its labor is from outside, you know, Shenzhen is, there's no real Shenzhen residents, as they say, because Shenzhen was a town of maybe 60,000 people just in the 1980s. And now it's a town of 11 million. So everybody's from the outside in Shenzhen. It took a little longer just because they had to wait for the people to come. If you have a lot of equipment and machinery, coming back might not be easy because your machinery hasn't been cycled in a long time. So, you know, companies that are successful when coming back with a lot of machinery are ones who get their maintenance people in, they do the lubrication, they do some of the preventative maintenance, they check things out, they make sure everything's set up properly so that it works like it's supposed to. They cycle the equipment, they make sure the equipment meets the statistical process control goals and can do what it's going to do. I mean, that's one of the big parts of the auto industry. When they go down, retool, and then breathe things up. Something I was used to, you know, just always getting your machinery ready. Your maintenance guys were extremely important during that time. One of the issues in China is there's not a really good maintenance culture there. So if you have a lot of equipment, usually your equipment is maintained by the supplier of the equipment. Their people come and they only have a certain amount of people. So, you know, you have to plan in advance to get those people in there to cycle your equipment, make sure everything's right, make sure everything is going properly. So that would be one of the biggest thing is maintenance and maintenance of the equipment. If especially if you're in a heavily automated or you know, you need real specific things. And the other thing is what we've talked about already is your supply chain ready. It's one thing for you to start up and maybe your management has done the greatest job in the world of starting up, but one of the parts doesn't come and you can't build. So people who are smart, in my opinion, not only work on their own factory, but take some of their supplier quality people and send them, or purchasing people, whoever, and send them to their supplier factories. Go and see if the supplier factory is ready. Help them. A lot of times the end user factory is the richer factory, and they have some extra engineers and things like that, and they can send it. One of the companies that's great at that is Toyota. Toyota constantly people, you know, to help the suppliers, and the rest of the automotive industry has started to do that also. Because again, if you can't get your seats from your supplier, your car, you're not making cars. You can't get the left front tire, you're not going to make a car. And that's the same with other industries. I mean, that's in consumer goods and anything. You know, we're a very integrated world right now. Very few people are vertically integrated. Most people are horizontally integrated. In other words, they have a lot of suppliers instead of making everything like by themselves. And so that factory that supplies you important parts is just as important as your own factory. And I don't think a lot of people consider that.
And I wanted to bring in the element of the financial element as well, because on the one side, you're absolutely right on the engineering side and on the manufacturing side. And on the other side, where personally, and I've had a couple of conversations recently, I see a potential issue, and big companies that I've spoken to have actually started to mitigate this by giving credit lines to their providers and vendors and tier one, tier two, and so on, is on the financing side, because some of these companies, depending on the size, when you shut down for 1, 2, 3 months or whatever it may be, you end up in a pretty serious cash flow problem. And that can lead to some serious consequences as well. So I think that financial element can play a very important part also in the whole scheme of things. I don't know how you view this side.
Well, that's a fact. You saw that at a couple of different times. In the 2008 financial crisis, you saw large and small, for example, automotive suppliers going bankrupt. And Mercedes, General Motors, Toyota, didn't matter whoever, you know, really had to go in and rescue these people. Sometimes they took over the factory themselves and paid the employees to keep the factory running while the company reorganized. This is something that constantly happens. And you know, big companies have a tendency to have financial people go in and make sure the books and things like that of their suppliers are good, unless there's a big disaster like what happened in the late 2000s. But if you're a medium-sized factory, let's say you're doing it somewhere between, you know, $80 to $400 million US dollars worth of work, you know, you do have some smaller suppliers, and these smaller suppliers can just disappear. And what happens if they disappear? Sometimes they disappear with your tooling, you know, your punches, your molds and things like that. So again, this is part of a long-term, I guess what at CMC, we call it the extended supply chain. And I've done some talks on that in China, because a lot of people don't think about their extended supply chain. They just think about the fact that we have a supply chain and that's that supplier's job. No, it's not. That supplier goes down financially and he goes bankrupt. You can't get a part, and maybe you have to spend another whole bunch of money on tooling and everything else because the bank owns your tooling now. The financial aspect of this is critical, and it's something that people constantly should be able to go. People need to understand that the supply chain, and especially the extended supply chain, is you. Their parts are your parts. Their parts go into your product. Their finances are your finances. You know, you see bad companies constantly trying to cut the price of their supplier without helping them learn how to save money. And they bankrupt their own suppliers sometimes, you know, looking at the financial thing. I need a 5% reduction. But they don't help them with maybe better engineering or better ways to manufacture, because a lot of these small people don't have the capabilities to learn how to manufacture better or engineer better. So, you know, this partnership that's really critical in long-term excellent manufacturing. It includes finance, quality, cost, the delivery, the entire situation coming together. Back in the day, Chrysler did a really good process called SCORE. So the SCORE thing worked very well. And a long time ago, the Dodge Durango factory, which was one of the first factories to use SCORE in Chrysler, there was a factory before us that did it too. But because we involved the suppliers so closely together, the suppliers helped us save like more than $500 million in cost, just by their ideas and our ideas and working together. Because the suppliers had engineers and we had engineers and we worked together as a team, and it was amazing the amount of money, the amount of waste and reduction and benefit that working together as a team. And, you know, we helped the suppliers. Just having the cheapest cost wasn't the cheapest price wasn't what we were looking for. So on the financial side, I would suggest to people that in China, people have a problem of only thinking about price instead of cost. The total cost is different than the price. If you can buy a widget for maybe, you know, 10 RMB, but the cost might cost you 15 because you have quality issues and everything else, but maybe you buy a widget for 12 RMB, but the overall cost is less because you have no quality problems. You don't have to rework it and things. So the price doesn't always equal the cost, and a lot of people don't pay attention. And that's one of the things that bankrupt companies and hurt them in financial situations like this. So yeah, the finance part is extremely important, and companies need to go back and see, does my supplier have the financial fortitude to go through this? And maybe you're accounting company or finance group have to go over there and check too to make sure they can start up. They might not be able to start up financially as well as manufacturing wise. You're right about that. That's a good point.
On the specific news that have been popping up, I mean, very specifically, actually, Japan, for example, allocated $2 billion for companies to relocate out of China, to relocate their manufacturing out of China back into Japan. We've seen more and more articles being written. I read something on Forbes the other day on US companies leaving China or accelerating the departure of their manufacturing from China. How do you see this? How do you see this angle? Because obviously we've also had before this crisis, we had the trade war, right? Which was pretty intense. It's still not clear how that will go after the crisis passes, but do you see this accelerating the shift of manufacturing out of China, or what's your take on it?
So there's two things about China. There are some people who are just constantly chasing cheap labor. The shoe industry is like that. You know, they went to China. They first went to Taiwan or in Mexico. Then they went to Taiwan. Then they went to China. Now they want to go to Africa or Cambodia or something just to find cheap labor, because a lot of these people don't want to change how they do business. And for me, this makes no sense. Just to pick up a whole factory and move it somewhere else so your labor's cheaper, because you don't want to do the hard work of engineering better manufacturing processes and things like that, make no sense to me. China is a gigantic country. I mean, probably somebody estimates, Standard Chartered Bank estimated that this was a few years ago, but they said in the next 15 years, 360 million, 400 million people are going to join the middle class. Well, that's the size of the European Union or the United States. That's a lot of people to do work with. So if you're leaving China because you're only an export-only group and that's all you're thinking about, you're not thinking about potentially selling to the Chinese internal market, yeah, I guess it's okay to leave, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me just to leave a market that could grow by 360 million people in the next 10 years, 10, 12 years. And a lot of people are finding out as they leave China, China has a pretty darn good infrastructure. You know, they have good ports, they have good roads, the electrical grid works. And people are going to some of these other countries where they don't have good ports, good grids. And if you're in the electronics industry, there's nobody like China for the electronics side, supply chain. So, you know, if you want to leave China, do it for the right business reasons. You know, I have a growth potential in Vietnam, and I can supply to Southeast Asia from Vietnam, better nights and flights from China. Okay, this makes a lot of sense to me. If I want to go to, I want to go to the Middle East because I can supply to Africa and Europe, and labor and energy is inexpensive in the Middle East. Let's go there. That makes sense to me. But just to leave doesn't make sense. Now, the Chinese government, you know, can do things like the U.S. government did for a while with too many regulations and too high of taxes. That, you know, was really the biggest reason people left the U.S. Now that taxes are getting lower and regulations are getting more intelligent, people are starting to go back to the U.S. Europe will probably be the same. People are going to Eastern Europe, though, because of low prices. And, you know, a lot of companies are like lemmings. They hear something, oh, let's go to Vietnam. Everybody goes to Vietnam. They don't really pay attention. They just think their board of directors wants them to do that. That's a little sad to me, too. But I still think China is going to be a strong, viable country. The people there are hard workers. They're not stupid. The question will be IP protection. The Chinese have to start doing IP protection. They don't do it very well. That was Trump's biggest thing in the trade war was IP protection. Because if you remember, Xi Jinping offered a lot of money to the U.S. to say, okay, we'll help you set up the, you know, fix up the trade deficit. But the trade deficit wasn't the issue. It was IP protection. And the Europeans were involved in that too. If China can get involved in good IP protection so that people don't lose their IP, you know, then I think China's going to continue to grow, and my company's betting on it. Our biggest piece of our operations are there, although we're in North America, Southeast Asia, and in the Middle East now. But nonetheless, you know, we still think China's going to be important to us, and so we're staying there for that reason, and especially manufacturing. Manufacturing will continue to be big. Mm. I see people leaving. Some people leave again, like I say, because of they don't want to work hard. It's easy. Just, you know, some of them just have really simple processes and it's cheaper just to go to Vietnam and do it or go to Cambodia to do it. But, you know, if you're really going to get into real live manufacturing, you know, and as people go to industry 4.0 and other things like that, you're going to have strong infrastructure, good people who know what they're doing. I would say China's biggest weakness on getting their manufacturing going better is this lack of maintenance, lack of technicians and things like that that know how to run robots. It's easy to put in robots, but it's not easy to keep them going. It's like a jet airplane. If you didn't fix the jet airplane, it would crash, you know? So you have to have preventative, predictive, and very strong maintenance systems. And I see that as the weakest piece of China's. So that's got to fix. But I think China's going to stay. I think China's going to be around for a while. I don't see it growing, and India's going to do the same thing. They're growing now. Mm. So I think this will be good.
For sure. I mean, ultimately, their internal market is huge. You know, 1.34 billion people. I guess where the discussion, and there's been quite a few pointers in terms of the crisis making supply chains reevaluate the globalization aspect of it and the term of glocal, right? Where There's a lot of talk about moving the supply chain and the manufacturing closer to the market. So exactly what you mentioned about, you know, maybe China or Vietnam or whatever for Southeast Asia, maybe Mexico for US, Canada, maybe, you know, Middle East for Africa, that could potentially happen in terms of parts of the manufacturing. But for sure, manufacturing for China, I also personally doubt that that will happen somewhere else. Right. I mean, for sure it will happen in China itself. Now, I wanted to ask you specifically that you've been part of, you've managed a plant basically when the swine flu hit Mexico 10 years ago, 11 years ago. It was a big thing back then. And you had to keep it running. And that's exactly the situation that a lot of people will be in the next couple of weeks in, you know, in the Western world and all over the world. Maybe can you share some tips and tricks of what to do, what not to do to keep it running? Of course, you don't want people getting infected. You don't want, you know, there's a lot of crisis management and safety and all of that that you need to look after in terms of a plan. Maybe give us your top three, four tips and tricks.
Let me give you a couple examples. And one of my best customers in the world is a company called Air Liquide. They're out of France. And they have a big factory in China and a big factory here in the Middle East. And it's the reason I started coming to the Middle East. We've been working with them since 2014. So I'll talk to you about what they're doing currently, which is really quite interesting. And then I'll talk about what we did in Mexico. We were a $3.5 billion P&L factory for Foxconn in Mexico. We were the largest in the Western Hemisphere. What Air Liquide's done, which is quite interesting, is they divided up how they do lunches, divided up how they do shifts a little bit differently. They've cut the shifts down to 6.5 hours so that they have more distance between the shifts so people don't get sick. They're constantly checking. They're making sure everybody's healthy. Everybody wears masks. Everybody wears gloves. They've staggered lunches so people aren't all bunched together at lunches. People are sitting one person per table and things like that so that people are distanced from themselves. And they did a fantastic job, in my opinion. And I was really, really quite proud to see how they did the work to make things go. It was a global effort from their whole team. And I have to say they did a nice job. And we did a similar job in 2009 and 10. When the swine flu hit, which was actually more infectious, it didn't go worldwide. It was just mainly in Mexico, the United States, a little bit in Canada. And it actually had killed many more people than it's been killed right now by COVID-19. But we had people coming in with masks. We supplied masks. We supplied gloves. We checked temperatures of all our employees and had close to 2,000 employees. So we had to... you know, we had a lot of people coming in. We had two shifts. We made sure each shift was set up the same way. We spaced out the lines a little bit better. We could do that because we had a little bit of, we had a tad bit of overcapacity, not a lot, but we were able to keep the people from interacting with each other closely. The other thing we did a good job, and I give Foxconn a lot of credit for this, they were quite up about it. They actually made us record anybody who got sick, anything that was going on, how we were handling it. We had to send that to the office in Taiwan on a daily basis. And they helped us if there was an issue. We fortunately didn't have anybody get sick with the disease that we knew of. And we also sent home instructions to families. We helped the families. And that was the other thing that was kind of nice because, you know, there's extended families and people live quite close together in Mexico, just like they do in China. And, you know, giving information to families on how to treat it and how to do, because your employee is part of a family that lives back home when they go home. And if they get sick, everybody gets sick. So we did an awful lot of work with making sure that the families were healthy, teaching them what to do, making sure that they got medical checks, and then making sure that inside we disinfected doors, we disinfected tooling on a regular basis. We had people walking around doing that. We also, again, the whole mask and glove thing was big. we put people at home who didn't have to be there, which a lot of people are doing in China and the rest of the world. And I'll tell you something anecdotal that happened out of that. An awful lot of the people that we kept them at home after a while, we found out that we were getting higher productivity in some functions from people at home. Like we had a lot of people in purchasing because we had quite an extended supply chain, and the people who were staying at home, they would work during the day a little bit, and then, you know, they would eat, they would take care of their kids. And then at night, because Taiwan was on, they would get on the phone with Taiwan and the computer with Taiwan in real time, instead of, you know, not doing it in real time. And so we actually got quite a bit more work out of the people, and they seemed to enjoy it. So we let them stay home, and then we would have every 2 weeks we would have a meeting of our purchasing or our finance people. They would come into the office, or we'd rent a hotel place and have donuts and coffee and things like that. So that was something incidental that we learned from that actually helped us be more productive. And I've used that since then with different places, especially since we have a worldwide supply chain now. You know, you give the people the opportunity, you give them their goals and objectives, they'll do the work. So that's basically what we did. I mean, we just really tried to take care of the people. If people were feeling ill, we brought a doctor on site on a regular basis to take a look at the people and things like that. So the doctor would come and check. So we got through it and really didn't have any problems. And it worked out for us pretty well. We didn't shut down for anything.
Oh, useful to know. I mean, I wasn't as deeply involved in supply chain at that point, but I do remember that was a very significant crisis for the North America. So quite a lot of lessons that can be very well applied for what we are experiencing today. And yeah, still applicable to this day for sure. look, David, thank you very much for all the sharing. Great case studies and very practical. And I think and I hope that the audience will take away quite a few things that they can do or look at from a manufacturing and very pragmatic standpoint. And thanks for joining us today. And hopefully, you know, this crisis goes away sooner rather than later, and we can go back to some level of normality. And you can also leave Dubai and go back to China.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I really appreciate your time, and I enjoyed myself.
Super.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcottglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in supply chain or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.